to. He walked a few blocks and found an internet cafe, one he had used before. He plugged in his laptop, got online, and typed a message to Julia Javier at Langley. Fondazza flat is ready to go. Should move in tonight. Laid eyes on our man, having a coffee with our friends. Would not have known him otherwise. Adjusting nicely to a new life. All is in order here. No problems whatsoever. After dark, the Fiat stopped in the middle of Via Fondazza, and its contents were quickly unloaded. Marco packed light because he owned practically nothing. Two bags of clothes and some Italian study books, and he was completely mobile. When he stepped into his new apartment, the first thing he noticed was that it was sufficiently heated. "This is more like it," he said to Luigi. "I'll move the car. Have a look around." He looked around, counted four rooms with nice furnishings, nothing extravagant, but a huge step up from the last place. Life was improving. 10 days ago, he had been in prison. Luigi returned in a rush. "What do you think?" "I'll keep it, thank you." "Don't mention it. And thank the folks in Washington, too." "Did you see the kitchen?" Luigi asked, flipping on a light switch. "Yes, it's perfect. How long do I stay here, Luigi?" "I don't make those decisions. You know that." "I know." They were back in the den. "A couple of things," Luigi said. "First, Ermanno will come here each day to help you study. 8 until 11. Then 2 until 5 or whenever you wish to stop." "Wonderful. Please get the boy a new flat, would you? His dump is an embarrassment to the American taxpayers. Second, this is a very quiet street. Mainly apartments. Come and go quickly. Don't chat with your neighbors. Don't make any friends. Remember, Marco, you are leaving a trail. Make it wide enough, and someone will find you." "I heard you the first 10 times. Then hear me again." "Relax, Luigi. My neighbors will never see me, I promise. I like it here. It's much nicer than my prison cell." Chapter 14. The memorial service for Robert Kritz was held in a country club-like mausoleum in a ritzy suburb of Philadelphia, the city of his birth, but a place he had avoided for at least the past 30 years. He died without a will and without a thought as to his final arrangements, leaving poor Mrs. Kritz with the burden of not only getting him home from London, but then deciding how to properly dispose of him. A son pressed the idea of cremation and a rather neat interment in a marble vault, one shielded from the weather. By that point, Mrs. Kritz would have agreed to almost any plan. Flying 7 hours across the Atlantic, in coach, with her husband's remains somewhere below her in a rather stark air transport box made especially for dead humans, had nearly pushed her over the edge. And then there had been the chaos at the airport when no one was there to greet her and take charge. What a mess! The service was by invitation only, a condition laid down by former President Arthur Morgan, who, after only 2 weeks on Barbados, was quite unwilling to return and be seen by anyone. If he was truly saddened by the death of his lifelong friend, he didn't show it. He had haggled over the details of the service with the Kritz family until he was almost asked to stay away. The date had been moved because of Morgan. The order of service didn't suit him. He reluctantly agreed to deliver a eulogy, but only if it could be very brief. Truth was, he had never liked Mrs. Kritz, and she had never liked him. To the small circle of friends and family, it seemed implausible that Robert Kritz would get so drunk in a London pub that he would stagger into a busy street and fall in front of a car. When the autopsy revealed a significant level of heroin, Mrs. Kritz had become so distraught that she insisted that the report be sealed and buried. She had refused to tell even her children about the narcotic. She was absolutely certain her husband had never touched an illicit drug. He drank too much, but few people knew it. But she nonetheless was determined to protect his good name. The London police had readily agreed to lock away the autopsy findings and close the case. They had their questions all right, but they had many other cases to keep them busy, And they also had a widow who couldn't wait to get home and put it all behind her. The service began at 2 on a Thursday afternoon. The time also dictated by Morgan so that the private jet could fly nonstop from Barbados to Philly International and lasted for an hour. 82 people had been invited and 51 showed up. A fair majority of them more curious to see President Morgan than to say goodbye to old Crits. A semi-Protestant minister of some variety presided. Crits had not seen the inside of a church in 40 years, except for weddings and funerals. The minister was faced with the difficult task of bringing to life the memory of a man he'd never met, and though he tried gamely, he failed completely. He read from the Book of Psalms. He offered a generic prayer that would have fit a deacon or a serial killer. He offered soothing words to the family, but again, they were total strangers to him. Rather than a heartwarming send-off, the service was as cold as the gray marble walls of the faux chapel. Morgan, with a bronze tan too ridiculous for February, attempted to humor the small crowd with some anecdotes about his old pal, but he came off as a man going through the motions and wanting desperately to get back on the jet. Hours in the Caribbean sun had convinced Morgan that the blame for his disastrous re-election campaign could be placed squarely at the feet of Robert Crits. He had told no one of this conclusion. There really was no one to confide in, since the beach mansion was deserted except for him and the staff of natives. But he had already begun to carry a grudge, to question the friendship. He didn't linger when the service finally ran out of gas and came to an end. He offered obligatory hugs to Mrs. Crits and her children, spoke briefly with some old friends, promised to see them in a few weeks, then rushed away with his mandatory Secret Service escort. News cameras had been stationed along a fence outside the grounds, but they caught no glimpse of the former president. He was ducking in the rear of one of two black vans. 5 hours later, he was by the pool watching another Caribbean sunset. Though the memorial drew a small crowd, it nonetheless was being keenly observed by others. While it was actually in progress, Teddy Maynard had a list of all 51 people in attendance. There was no one suspicious. No name raised an eyebrow. The killing was clean. The autopsy was buried, thanks in part to Mrs. Crits, and thanks also in part to strings pulled at levels much higher than the London police. The body was now ashes, and the world would quickly forget about Robert Crits. His idiotic foray into the Bachman disappearance had ended with no damage to the plan. The FBI had tried and failed to mount a hidden camera inside the chapel. The owner had balked, then refused to bend despite enormous pressure. He did allow hidden cameras outside, and these provided close shots of all the mourners as they entered and left. The live feeds were edited, the list of 51 quickly compiled, and an hour after the service ended, the director was given a briefing. The day before the death of Robert Crits, the FBI received some startling information. It was completely unexpected, unsolicited, and delivered by a desperate corporate crook staring at 40 years in a federal prison. He had been the manager of a large mutual fund who had been caught skimming fees, just another Wall Street scandal involving only a few billion bucks. But his mutual fund was owned by an international banking cabal, and over the years the crook had worked his way into the inner core of the organization. The fund was so profitable, thanks in no small measure to his talent for skimming, that the profits could not be ignored. He was voted onto the board of directors and given a luxury condo in Bermuda, the corporate headquarters for his very secretive company. In his desperation to avoid spending the rest of his life in prison, he became willing to share secrets, banking secrets, offshore dirt. He claimed he could prove that former President Morgan, during his last day in office, had sold at least one pardon for $3 million. The money had been wired from a bank on Grand Cayman to a bank in Singapore, both banks being secretly controlled by the cabal he'd just left. The money was still hiding in Singapore in an account opened by a shell corporation that was really owned by an old crony.